Hello, I'm Stephen Taibbi. This is number 0598, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0598. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Phil Sklar, the co-founder and CEO of the National Bobblehead Hall of Fame and Museum. They have turned Senator Bernie Sanders into a bobblehead. How was that decision made?
With Bernie, we had an employee who was watching the inauguration while working from home and saw the moment take off and explode on social media. And she sent us a message right away saying, you know, make it this, you had to look into doing this bobblehead right away. So we went to Twitter, saw it trending and got it in the works. And within, say, about 4 hours, we announced the bobblehead available for pre-order. And now it's become our second best-selling bobblehead of all time already. And it's been sold all over the country and all over the world, people pre-ordering the bobblehead.
We remember actress Cloris Leachman, who died this past week. How did she get the role of Phyllis on the Mary Tyler Moore Show?
I went in there and apparently I said, who's the big cheese here, or who can make decisions, or who's the big deal? And they pointed this man. I went over apparently and sat on his lap. I remember doing that. That's stupid. Well, it was Jim Brooks. He's a genius, and I love him, so I really do. He is a genius.
Science writer Andrew Vazekas, the night sky guy, talks about, among other things, space trash and also wine in space.
This was Bordeaux wine from France that was lifted up over a year ago, put up to the International Space Station. The idea here is to see how the wine ages in space. And they were now brought back after being over a year in space, and they will be uncorked and tasted by a professional connoisseur wine tasters to see how, in fact, wine does age over time in space.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0598, was Stephen Taibbi, a double heart transplant recipient and the author of Grateful Guilt, Living in the Shadow of My Heart. He's been on the show a couple of times in the past. You can listen to his previous appearances by going to our website at thestufffile.com and checking out shows number 0545 and also number 0525. He was on both of those shows. Thank you very much, Stephen, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? 48-year-old Lisa Boothroyd of Rugby in Warwickshire, England, got a shock when a handful of popping candy she ate turned out to be small novelty fireworks used as noisemakers instead. The box of Fun Snaps was shelved, among other candies, at her local Costcutter store, and the packaging was similar, but the result was painful. Boothroyd reported chemical burns on her lips and gums and a cracked tooth. That moment I crunched down was terrifying, she said. I felt explosions in my mouth, followed by a burning pain. A spokesperson for Costcutters said the Fun Snaps would be removed from the confectionery section with immediate effect. Yeah. You know, there are some products that advertise themselves as a taste sensation that's an explosion for your mouth, but I don't think this is what they had in mind.
The taste is gonna move ya. Take a sniff, pull it out. The taste is gonna move ya when you pop it in your mouth.
Exactly. An Oklahoma state representative introduced a bill that would establish a hunting season for one of the state's most infamous species of alleged native wildlife, Bigfoot. Representative Justin Humphrey, the Republican for District 19, introduced a bill to the state legislature that would call on the Oklahoma Wildlife Commission to designate a Bigfoot hunting season. The mythical ape has been the subject of numerous sightings in southern Oklahoma for years, and the region hosts an annual Bigfoot festival for fans of the cryptid. The bill states the Oklahoma Wildlife Conservation Commission will promulgate rules establishing a Bigfoot hunting season. The commission shall set annual season dates and create any necessary specific hunting licenses and fees. The bill, if passed by the legislature and signed by the governor, would take effect on November the 1st. Yeah. What could possibly go wrong? Some swarthy, hirsute foreigner gets gunned down by a nearsighted racist, but he gets off because he had a Bigfoot hunting license? Perhaps. Anyway, moving right along, in a first for paleontologists, the perfectly preserved anus of a dinosaur has been found in China. Psittacosaurus, a Cretaceous period relative of the Triceratops, was about the size of a dog, and researcher Jacob Vinther of the University of Bristol in the United Kingdom describes the discovery as unique. It's like a Swiss Army knife of excretory openings used for pooping, peeing, breeding, and egg laying. It was not clear to the researchers whether the dinosaur was male or female. Okay, I know dinosaurs had tiny brains, but within that tiny brain, I'm sure they had at least an ounce of dignity. I bring that up because between the news of this and also the latest discovery in Egypt of an ancient crypt full of mummies, I have to ask, when it comes to paleontologists and archaeologists, is there a fine timeline between archaeology and grave robbing? I mean, are you worried that thousands of years from now, someone is going to dig up your anus? Just asking. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, we have one more story to share with you before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And this next story is one that makes you want to ask, what the heck is going on in Missouri? Authorities who pulled over a pickup truck in Aylesbury, Missouri, soon discovered the vehicle had been stolen, so they headed to the owner's home, where they found skeletal remains in another vehicle in the garage and a ransacked house. Lincoln County Sheriff Rick Harrell said the body may have been there since last summer, and a group of criminal opportunists had just ransacked the residence and taken many items. "We've recovered stolen vehicles, stolen firearms, and tens of thousands of dollars in other related items." Sheriff Harrell goes on to say that the scavengers would have had to walk right past the body for months as they removed items. Prosecutors are working to bring charges against 25 suspects, and there may be more. Investigators have not yet identified the remains or determined exactly when the person died. Wow. I take back what I said in the previous story. Unlike paleontologists and archaeologists, these people aren't even willing to wait. How ghoulish is that? Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Because of his appearance at the presidential inauguration, Senator Bernie Sanders has become a meme for his inauguration attire. Not only that, he's become a bobblehead. The bobblehead was announced by the National Bobblehead Hall of Fame and Museum. This has led me to wanting to know more about bobbleheads in general. So joining us via Skype from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is Phil Sklar, who is the co-founder and CEO of the National Bobblehead Hall of Fame and Museum. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. I think a lot of people were familiar with bobbleheads if you ever been to a bobblehead day at a baseball stadium. I was unaware of the fact that there was a National Bobblehead Hall of Fame and Museum. How long has this been in existence?
Yeah, we get that every once in a while. We announced the idea for the museum in 2014. We had a preview exhibit in 2016, and then we opened the permanent museum in 2019. So we've been around for a while. We've been creating bobbleheads since about 2014 as well. So more and more people continue to find out about us as we continue to make more and more bobbleheads and get more press attention for the museum as well.
Am I right in assuming, as I said earlier, that one of the things we all know about as far as bobbleheads are concerned are usually tied to sports?
Yeah, so about 80% of the bobbleheads that are out there are sports related, although there are quite a few non-sports bobbleheads, and some of the all the earliest bobbleheads were actually non-sports, so more decorative figurines or characters, political figures from 1960 were some of the earliest bobbleheads that were available in North America. So they do have a strong history outside of sports, but people do now associate them mostly with sports.
So let's talk about your organization. You, again, as the National Bobblehead Hall of Fame, I'm assuming that also you are the makers of bobbleheads. I'm also assuming that you're not the only makers of bobbleheads.
Yeah, that would be correct. So we realized in 2013 timeframe that there was no museum dedicated to bobbleheads in the world. And we had, me and the other co-founder, a growing collection of, at that time, about 3,000 unique bobbleheads that we had collected through traveling and trading and buying, selling. And so we also set out to produce a bobblehead of a friend of ours to raise money for Special Olympics and to honor him. And at that time, we realized, oh, there could be a need in the market to produce bobbleheads. There was other companies out there producing them, but most of them were focused on the promotional bobbleheads that are given away at stadiums. So we put those two ideas together, and here we are.
How did you get an interest in bobbleheads in the first place? Because as you mentioned, you were a collector, and you had apparently quite a few.
Yeah, so it started out with collecting baseball cards, which my dad got me into when I was growing up. Probably got my first cards when I was a few days old. He collected cards growing up in the 60s, and so it was something that I've sort of always had a passion for collecting. And then 2003, Brad, the other co-founder, was working for the minor league baseball team in Rockford, Illinois, where we grew up, and they gave away bobblehead for the first time then in 2003, and he got one. And we were going to school in Milwaukee, so as big sports fans, we circled the Bucks and the Brewers and the other sports games that had bobblehead giveaways so we could start building up a collection. And, you know, we saw online that some of the bobbleheads, it might be given away at a Brewers game one day, and the next day they're selling for $50 or $75 on eBay. And so we thought, hey, this might be something fun to collect and could also be something that could increase in value.
So out of your collection, what would you consider your prize bobblehead to be?
Yeah, so that's always a tough one, but we do have some from the 1960s. We have a very rare San Francisco 49ers bobblehead that's a rare variation of one. We also have the Beatles set, and probably the most unique one is a mold, about a 5-pound cast iron mold that was made to use for some of the very first bobbleheads from 1960 for the first sports football bobblehead. So that one's a one-of-a-kind item.
Has the making or the design of bobbleheads changed over the years?
Yeah, so it has developed quite a bit. We couldn't have done this Bernie bobblehead, Bernie in his chair, you know, with all these intricate details, even 15 years ago. If people think back to the late 90s or early 2000s, those sort of a puffy face person, you know, whether it was, you know, Barry Bonds or Sammy Sosa, some of those baseball players that were the first bobbleheads when they came back into popularity in the late 90s and early 2000s. The technology has just changed a lot. The detail that we can do is just remarkable compared to those times. And so, yeah, you get a lot more unique and fun bobbleheads these days compared to what you saw in the 60s and the 90s.
Now, again, I mentioned the Hall of Fame. People can go to your website, which is bobbleheadhall.com. What will people find when they go to the website, first of all? And also, what's the experience like when they physically go to your museum?
Yeah, so the website has a ton of information about the history of bobbleheads, how they're made, the story behind them. We replicate that experience at the museum, so you'll find a history wall with the details of how bobbleheads started and how they've developed over time, the stories behind a lot of the bobbleheads. You'll find about 6,500 unique bobbleheads in the collection at the museum. We don't have all those shown on the website. We have a sort of a snapshot on the website, but we do have a virtual tour that we put up on the website for people who can't make it to the museum, and now being closed for the coronavirus gives people a chance to enjoy safely from home. So that's right on the website. People can take a 360-degree tour. If you come to the museum, you can put a pin in the map to show where you're visiting from. We've had visitors from all 50 states and about 25 different countries since we opened in February of 2019. You'll also find a gift shop with about 500 unique bobbleheads at the museum. And our online store, you can go to our online store and find about 3,500 different bobbleheads that you can purchase.
And let's get back to Bernie, because it was announced that by you, the National Bobblehead Hall of Fame and Museum, that he was going to become a bobblehead. How do you go about deciding what becomes a bobblehead, and how often do you have new ones?
Yeah, so we're always looking out for things that are trending or people that are popular, and seeing, especially if they've never had a bobblehead before or if it's a new pose, we'll try to turn that into a bobblehead. And with Bernie, we had an employee who was watching the inauguration while working from home and saw the moment take off and explode on social media, and she sent us a message right away saying, you know, make it this, you had to look into doing this bobblehead right away. So we went to Twitter, saw it trending, and got it in the works, and within, say, about 4 hours, we announced the bobblehead available for pre-order, and now it's become our second best-selling bobblehead of all time already, and it's been sold all over the country and all over the world, people pre-ordering the bobblehead. But yeah, we come out with new ones almost on a weekly basis, and just really have a lot of fun with it. We take people's suggestions. If they, you know, have something that they see that should be a bobblehead, we'll definitely consider that as well.
You say it's the number two bestseller that you've had. What's number one?
Yeah, so number one has been Dr. Fauci. So we've sold more Dr. Fauci bobbleheads than any other bobblehead in history.
Wow. And generally speaking, what is the what are most of the bobbleheads depicting? Are they sports figures? Are they politicians? I mean, you've got two political figures that are number one and number two right now.
Yeah, so when people come to the museum, it's organized by category, and about 75% to 80% of the museum is sports, so baseball, basketball, football, hockey. Then you have your other sports like golf and tennis and wrestling and UFC, which are also represented. But yeah, there's politicians, comics, movies, TV, really anything and everything that you can think of. It's been depicted in bobblehead form, and I think that's what makes it so fun. They've been the same for so long, but you can really turn anything and everything into a bobblehead.
And again, I'm used to seeing bobbleheads and getting bobbleheads from when I was a kid as part of a sports promotion. What do bobbleheads generally sell for, like the Bernie one, for instance?
Yeah, so most of the bobbleheads that we sell on our website range from $25 to $40, sometimes $50. And even the bobbleheads that are given away for free at a game, you'll see selling sometimes for in the $100 plus range right after a game, because somebody from, you know, Milwaukee might not want to go to California you're not going to go to California just to get the bobblehead. So you'll hop on eBay and pick one up there, or go on a Facebook group dedicated to bobbleheads and try to trade or buy one there. So it's about supply and demand. And sometimes, most of the time, there's not enough bobbleheads produced to satisfy that demand, because a lot of times, even at a game, you know, they'll only give away 10,000 bobbleheads, even though there's 40,000 fans there.
So in the case of something like the Bernie bobblehead, how many would you make?
Yeah, so we're going to finalize that number shortly, but it'll probably be in the 25 to 30,000 bobblehead range.
So in the grand scheme of things, that's pretty rare, considering people buying online can buy it from anywhere in the world.
Yeah, so it is. They end up being pretty limited. You know, people have to find out about it, and sometimes people miss out, and then they'll email us and say, "Hey, I wanted to buy that, that bobblehead," and once they're gone, they're gone. And we usually individually number them as well. So this Bernie bobblehead will be individually numbered. And once they're gone, they'll be gone.
I would assume, like any entity that people can venture into as far as the public is concerned, I would assume that you guys are also suffering with the pandemic. Has it been a bit of a downturn for the museum?
Yeah, so for the physical museum itself, it has been, but we pivoted really quickly with the Bernie, but the Dr. Fauci bobblehead, and now with the Bernie bobblehead, but we also did bobbleheads of 12 different governors and 35 different essential hero professions. And so that kept us extremely busy and actually was our busiest year ever. So we were able to pivot, and we were also able to raise, through the Dr. Fauci bobblehead and those associated bobbleheads, over $300,000 for the Protect the Heroes Fund to get PPE to frontline healthcare workers. So we wanted to make a difference, and that's, we were able to do that through the bobbleheads.
Well, that's fantastic. And again, people can find out more information by going to the website, which is bobbleheadhall.com. Phil, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was great to join you.
Phil Sklar, the co-founder and CEO of the National Bobblehead Hall of Fame and Museum. You can go to my website at thestuffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0598, and you'll find the links to their website. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the comic book. It all comes to you here on The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Andrew Vazekas, the night sky guy, plus... we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way here on a program that's heard everywhere for all your devices, including Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. You can also find it on several fine radio stations such as WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, WLSL LPFM in Dade City, Florida, CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, CKLU 96.7 FM in Sudbury, and CKHR Hay River in the Northwest Territories. Thanks to all for joining in, and don't touch that dial. We're going to skip doing some more Stuff File news right here because we have a very special segment coming up right here, right now. One of the most naturally funniest women on the planet, actress Cloris Leachman, who won multiple awards, including an Oscar and 9 Emmys, died on January 26 at the age of 94. She was a marvelous human being, in addition to being a fine actress. Whenever someone asks me, who is the celebrity you most enjoy talking to? It is without a doubt, Cloris Leachman. She's also the first chapter in my book. Here's a portion of the one-hour conversation I had with Cloris, which ironically was live on the radio 16 years to the day before her death. A conversation from January 26, 2005.
With all the things that you've done, and it seems to be everyone in your family is just multifaceted and multi-talented. You're talking about yourself playing the piano. What is your passion? What do you get the biggest kick from?
Oh, I guess just around the table. When we have dinner, breakfast together, we're so hilarious. I mean, my just the funniest. I've just been sick that people can't really see the fun. Oh, my God, brilliant humor. You just beg for mercy.
Laughter, I take it, is very, very important for you.
Oh, yes, very, very important. Very crucial.
Now, you originally came from Chicago, if I'm not mistaken.
Wrong? No, I was born and grew up in Des Moines, actually outside of Des Moines in the country.
Okay.
And I went to Northwestern, so that's where I got into the Illinois, the Chicago part.
Okay, now, but you did enter a pageant.
No, I did not enter the pageant. I don't mean to make you wrong here, but...
Okay, correct me. Go ahead.
Somebody who who worked for an ad agency in Chicago would come out to Northwestern University if he needed somebody to pose for an ad that they were doing. So they'd come out there, and I did a few of them with them. And then apparently they were having the Miss WGN contest, and so he put my picture in the contest, and I didn't even know about it until I came home one night very late and found this telegram saying, congratulations, you're one of 12 finalists in 20 contests around the city, and I was Miss WGN, and so I was supposed to be there that next night at 7 p.m. with talent. I said, please bring talent. I had to pack up my talent and an evening gown and a bathing suit. Well, I just put it away and went to bed. I had no intention of doing anything. That is not what I do or wanted to do. The next afternoon, he called and said he'd drive me down there. I said, well, no, I'm not going. It was too ridiculous. Well, he insisted, and a woman I was staying with in Evanston, Illinois that summer, where I was working there, she said, oh, you have to go. She was just like Blondie in Dagwood.
Right.
You know, Blondie. So they both talked me into it, and I went down there laughing all the way, just thinking it was hilarious. Anyway, I won this darn thing. I'd played the piano a little bit, and I'd danced a little bit and sang a little bit, and what else do you want me to do? And they said, well, take your hair down. I hadn't even washed my hair. It was up in a pin, you know, like in the movies where you take off your glasses and let your hair down with one pin. But it had curled itself, and it just fell around my shoulders. And they said, well, congratulations, you're Miss WGN. Well, I just laughed so hard I had to be careful. They were getting their feelings hurt, so I got serious, and somebody said, what will you do on Friday night if you win Miss Chicago? What Friday night? What Miss? I didn't know anything about it. So I ran out the next day and took a piano lesson and bought a new bathing suit. Showed up Friday, and they showed us the figure eight. We had to walk, and they said it's very sedate, and it's at this hall, very nice. And I wasn't even a state. I mean, there's a Miss Illinois and a Miss Iowa and a Miss, you know, all of those. So anyway, I stayed while they all went to dinner, and I walked this figure eight about 100 times. Just to get used to it, really. So now that the very last part of that, they couldn't decide among three of us. And so they said, would you say something? It was very casual in those days. And so the first girl was tongue-tied, and the next girl lisped. And I got up. I didn't know what to say, but I said, well, I'm not even from here. I'm from Iowa. There was a Miss Iowa. There was a Miss Illinois. And they just put this city, Miss Chicago. I was the only city in the whole thing. Isn't that funny? Well, anyway, here I was. So I said, but my grandmother always said, and I put my finger out crooked, and I said, you get in there and bring home the bacon. And they, congratulations, you're Miss Chicago. Oh, my God. And that meant I was on to Miss America contest. So I called my mother. I said, you better get here because this is getting serious. So she flew in with me, and then we went to Atlantic City together. And then my father came the last day, and I was one of the finalists. I won a $1,000 scholarship. And he gave me $60 to go to New York for 3 days from Atlantic City, and I stayed 8 years.
And had you ever done any pageant before that?
Never, no.
None.
My legs are too short.
The role that a lot of people remember you best for, I guess, would be the role you played on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, where you played Phyllis.
Mm-hmm.
How did that role come to you, Phyllis Lindstrom?
Well, you can read Mary's book, her autobiography that she wrote several years ago, many years ago. But I read it and remembered. I hadn't thought about it all those years. And so from what she said, it was all true. I just don't quite remember exactly, but I'll tell you. I went in there, and apparently I said, who's the big cheese here, or who can make decisions, or who's the big deal? And they pointed at this man. I went over apparently and sat on his lap. I remember doing that. That's stupid. Well, it was Jim Brooks.
The same director who did Spanglish.
Yeah.
Right.
And he wrote it. So He's a genius, and I love him, so I really do. He is a genius.
How much of Cloris is in Phyllis, or vice versa?
I don't know. I think Phyllis was trying awfully hard to be the best at everything, every department, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A whore in the bedroom, a chef in the kitchen, a chauffeur with the kids and the psychologist and, you know, everything you're supposed to be. To be the complete woman and was really insufferable, therefore.
That was a very long run on that show when you first signed up on that show. And it's not the first television series you did. When you first signed up on the show, did you get a sense, get a feeling that, you know, this was a hit?
I think it took a year for it to take off. I think they were in trouble for the first year. I don't think it was a big hit instantly from what I hear. I didn't pay too much attention, but that's what I've been told.
But the writing certainly was there, wasn't it?
Oh, we had a wonderful time, and I never questioned it. I didn't expect that it wouldn't keep going.
That was just a snippet of a conversation I had with Cloris Leachman. There's more, but I wanted to set it up a little bit first. After a commercial break, I came back and continued to talk with Cloris. Now, since I was in the studio and she was in California, I could turn my microphone on and off when she was speaking. At the time, I had a massive cold when I spoke to her, so I kept turning off my mic to cough, especially because she kept making me laugh. At this point, which you'll now hear, we ended up in a giggle fit. I almost coughed up a lung.
We are talking with actress Cloris Leachman. She is an Academy Award winner and also a multiple Emmy Award winner. And Cloris, just how many Emmys do you have?
Well, I guess I have a record 8.
Wow.
8 Emmys. 4, and I tied when I had 6 Emmys. 5 of them were for different roles. And I was tied with Sir Laurence Olivier for the same amount. But he was kind enough to die so that he wouldn't, you know, be winning all the time. Thoughtful enough. Poor dear man. Then I went on, now I have 8. Mary Tyler Moore was, it was so funny. She said, you have 8 Emmys? I said, yeah. She said, I thought you had 7. I said, no, I have 8. You have 8 Emmys? Yeah. She said, well, I thought I had the most. I said, I don't know, I have 8. It was a lovely moment for me, I must say. Very exciting.
I'm just getting over that Laurence Olivier line.
I know it. Oh. Oh, isn't that funny?
Where do you keep them all?
Well, they always just sort of by default end up somewhere. I have what I call Leachman's Folly. I sold my beautiful, wonderful house. It was kind of a country house, a one-story country house in Mandeville Canyon in the woods, magical woods. I had made it just perfect, you know, very, a lot of character and beautiful. But the first thing I looked at was a condo, and it turned out to be the most, I bought it instantly, and there's a loft over the dining room, and I built a counter there. Because you can look out, there are two-story windows in this two-story condo. So you can look up from the loft outside these beautiful windows to this wonderful hundreds and hundreds of acres of eucalyptus trees. So that counter became where somebody put all these Emmys and the Academy Award, and I have a Golden Globe and other things. They're all there. And they look nicer. It's sort of stupid, but it makes a nice place for them. That's kind of a dumb answer, isn't it?
No, it's not. No, they have to go somewhere, right?
That's exactly right. They have to go somewhere.
And
what's that story about this man who was having an affair with this guy's wife, and they're in the bedroom, and just suddenly he says, what's that? She says, oh, my God, my husband's coming. He said, oh, my God, where's the window? She said, there isn't one. He says, where would you like one?
It seems to be, looking over your resume and the career you've had, that there's nothing you can't do. Has there been a situation where there was a role you wanted and somebody said no?
Oh, sure. This is a bad, mean story. It's a very mean story, but it is funny. I shouldn't tell it. But
oh, go ahead.
Care. She wouldn't care.
Okay.
I love to dance more than life itself. I think I was the best, one of the best dancers in high school, you know, and it was so such fun. So now they're doing, years ago, Queen of the Stardust Ballroom on television. It had been on the stage, and they were doing it on television. Well, of course, I wanted to play that more than anything. So I called the producers, which I'd never done before, but I said, I'd love to play this part. They said, oh, no, Cloris, you're not right for it. I said, but I could be. You haven't seen me. Well, let me come in and show you. Could I just, no, you're not right for it. Oh, please, let me come. Come on, you guys. And let me do. No, you're not right for it. They said, we want somebody whose legs rub together. I said, you already got Maureen? And they said, yes. They had hired Maureen Stapleton. Isn't that awful? No, but, you know, they wouldn't even see me about it. Not too bad. I always wanted to do that. Then I couldn't do Peter Pan because Mary Martin already did that. So
right.
Those are my two heartbreakers.
In chronological order, the last picture show came out in 71.
Mm-hmm.
But when did you shoot it? In other words, had you started shooting it before you started on Mary Tyler Moore Show?
I did the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and then on the break, I did that movie. Oh. I did the last picture show.
Because it's also very unusual. I mean, you got the Academy Award for the last picture show.
Mm-hmm.
And usually people always try to make a separation. Certainly the studios do, or the studio heads do. They try to make a separation between people who do television and people who do film.
Mm-hmm. And well, in those days, absolutely, it was very unusual.
And here comes this woman who just waltzes into a movie, gets an Academy Award, goes back to the television show.
Huh.
It was very unusual. You don't hear very many people doing that.
Well, you know, thank God they're softening about all that. And on Broadway now, it's almost as if you have to be a television name before you can do Broadway. And it used to be, you know, impossible. There was almost no crossover at all. There is in England that people are out on the road all the time and on the stage all the time and then come and do films in England. But America is very separated for the most part.
What was it like to step away from the ensemble cast of the Mary Tyler Moore Show and step into the forefront in your own spin-off?
Well,
as
that's
Phyllis.
A good question. It's very tricky. You can't take a character out of an ensemble like that and expect that it'll just be like cake, because the person is identified by the other people around the person. That's who tells you what you are, how they react to you, in other words. You create each other by the way you react to each other a lot of the times. So it was tricky, and I think being the sort of pain in the neck that Phyllis was created to be, and now playing the lead on my own series as Phyllis, it was tricky to make her likable and lovable as the heroine and still have the irritating, funny stuff that her personality on the Mary Tyler Moore Show had. Thank God I'm not a writer and didn't have that. I didn't have to trouble my pretty head about it. But one week, I'd have to think, Jesus, how far are we going? How far to lean into something, you know?
Another television series that you did, which I was reminded of today by someone else who said, ask her about this show, The Nut House, that you did in 1989.
I love doing that. And Mel Brooks, it was his idea, and he was there a lot, and he wanted me to be Frau Blücher all over again. So what I did was, instead of having great big two front things sticking out, I made a great big high fat ass. And I also, what is it about girls are very, very good, and when they're bad, they are horrid, or something like that.
Yeah.
So I made a little spit curl in the middle of my forehead, but I to show that I wasn't a bad one. I was a good little girl. I'd pin it in every day. Well, the thing that went wrong there was that the man who wrote it, really created it a lot, I don't know what happened to him, but he made everybody so mad, the network and Disney Studios and everything, that they finally just had enough of him. You know, you need to shape that kind of stuff. It was fun doing, though, and Harvey's so darling to work with.
Harvey,
now, are we going to have time to talk about George's book?
You know what? We had George on 2 weeks ago.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah.
Were you able to read it?
Yeah, I just got it, so I am definitely going to do it.
Well, it's about a two, if you really... You don't want to put it down, and it takes about 2 days.
The book you're referring to is The Way It's Never Been Done Before, My Friendship with Marlon Brando, which is written by George Englund, who is your ex.
Well, I don't like to say that. I like to say he's my once-upon-a-time husband.
Ah, okay.
That has more of a storybook quality than somebody you blot out when you're finished with them.
Obviously, you have a very good relationship between the two of you.
Well, I don't like to have been so wrong as to have an ex. You know, God, I adore him. I'm still madly in love with him. I still fall in love with him every time I see him again. I really do. It's just an amazing chemistry and connection forever, you know.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I do hope that people will read this. He's a brilliant writer. It's like a tell-all book. Somebody said it's like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. You know, it's a boy to get inside Marlon's brain, his mind, and how deeply they were connected, and how, oh, these stories are just rich and rare. You'll never read a mind like this, I don't think, anywhere, like Marlon's, and the things they did together, and the Oh, God, it's a piece of history, really.
From the little...
Don't forget it. It's called The Way It's Never Been Done Before, because that's really the way Marlon acted. He wanted... And Georgia produced The Ugly American, starring Marlon Brando, many years ago. So, anyway, they became very deep, fast friends forever, and...
The thing that, from the little I've gleaned of the book so far, the thing that I find most interesting about it is, yes, of course, there's the story of Marlon Brando, but everyone should have a friendship like that.
Yes.
That's the most important thing.
They were, yes.
Yeah.
Very bad when he died.
Do you ever have plans to retire? Please say no.
Oh, God, you have to get a lead pipe. No, I don't. Can't imagine such a thing. But I'm not working like a chicken with my head off. It's a leisurely thing. I mean, lots of times I don't work, and I have a wonderful life, wonderful. I wish it for anybody who would like to have a wonderful life, to be in such a lovely, to be doing wonderful stuff, you know, with wonderful people, creative people. Sometimes I thank God I'm not a butcher, not to put butchers down, but to have to be cutting up dead animals with kind of real cold fingers and joints. Wouldn't that be awful? Or a plumber with my head down some, you know, pipe. I wouldn't be good at that.
When you first started your career, did you ever dream and anticipate that this is how your career would have turned out?
Mainly, I remember thinking, I don't want to end up an old lady with nobody to love and nobody to be loved by. Just some old lady with a career. You know, I never wanted to make that my focus. So I never thought about having a career. It's what I do that I really love and I'm good at. But it's not where my heart is.
Right. Well, it's been an absolute honor and pleasure and a joy to have a chance to talk to you.
I hope it was interesting to people. I mean, we talked a lot about my career, but...
Oh, absolutely. And as I said, two of my favorite films, Young Frankenstein and also High Anxiety. I laugh out loud.
High Anxiety.
I laugh out loud just when you walk on the screen.
Oh, yeah,
before you even say anything.
It was the drapes. The drapes. Dr. Ashley felt that color has a great deal to do with the well-being of the emotionally disturbed.
I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
They say that laughter is the best medicine. No word of a lie. After an hour of talking to Cloris and laughing, my cold had completely broken. Cloris was just a shining ray of sunshine. And yes... Her Once Upon a Time husband's book about his friendship with Marlon Brando is an amazing read. Again, the title is The Way It's Never Been Done Before, My Friendship with Marlon Brando. You'll find an Amazon link on this week's show, which is show number 0598, if you want to check out this great read. And Stuff File program fans, you can hear the full version of this conversation by going to our Patreon page and becoming one of the select patrons of the show. There is a much more robust version of this conversation, almost 40 minutes long, with this hysterically funny woman. Not only have I left in most of the conversation we had, but I've also left in her interaction with some of the callers. She was funny and sweet all at the same time. Just go to patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. As for Cloris, I know that living to 94 is a long time, but in the case of Cloris Leachman, it wasn't nearly long enough. She will be missed. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Latitude 47 degrees 14 minutes north. Longitude 84 degrees 39 minutes west. Location Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy. It's radio that's out of this world.
Andrew Fazekas is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. And Andrew, we have wine in space and trash in space. Sounds like a frat party.
Yeah, space is one busy place. That's a huge traffic jam going up there.
Yeah, let's talk about the trash in space first, because that's a more serious issue. And it's something that I'm sure many people thought of quite some time, because we just keep sending things up. And of course, none of it's coming back. So there's a lot of it up there.
There sure is, Peter. I mean, this is becoming a crisis, actually, that thankfully is getting more attention. Even in Europe, this past week, they are now dedicating funds in terms of seeing how we can mitigate this, how we can solve a little bit, at least some methods of developing, of getting rid of some of that junk in space. You know, in recent years, a big problem, Peter, has been that satellites have become smaller. They can be really, really small, weigh as little as 1 gram, some of them, and they're cheaper to make. A lot of the components are off-the-shelf kind of stuff. It's really incredible. And they're now putting so many of these up. They're called mega constellations. So you're basically having groups of hundreds or even thousands of these small satellites all working together. They're in orbit around the Earth, and they're in what's called low Earth orbit, most of them. So that means they're up somewhere between like 100 to 800 kilometers in altitude. And it's becoming extremely so busy that they're a hazard for collision. And in fact, the International Space Station, which is about 400 kilometers above our heads, has had to move aside for some of this clutter that's up there. And that's not even factoring what we think is bits and pieces, shards of metal, and components of satellite that have resulted from past collisions. We think there's at least over 120 million pieces of artificial human-made junk that's floating around in low Earth orbit. And what the fear is, Peter, is that if this continues, there'll be a day where we won't be able to safely be able to launch into orbit anything without the fear of collision.
When you talk about these mini satellites to space junk to shards to other things, generally speaking, from the smallest to the largest, what are we talking about as far as space trash is concerned?
Well, there's all kinds of things. You could have really some of the largest components out there are like rocket boosters, you know, from old mission to defunct satellites that could be the size of an SUV, to smaller satellites, the newer versions they're called CubeSats. And some of them are as small as, say, a loaf of bread. That's small. Right now, we think there's approximately 3,000 active satellites in orbit around the Earth. And this, we think, is going to skyrocket in the coming years. And that's because private industry and the public sector, so governments, both private and public entities, are planning on launching a lot more of these satellites, smaller ones particularly, in these constellations they're calling. So many of them have announced plans to launch thousands. Very interesting, SpaceX is one of them. They're planning on putting on internet-based satellites. So democratizing the access to the internet is very important. So folks in very remote regions can have access where there's no broadband communication capability, no landlines available. They are going to have the ability to have satellite-based internet.
Okay, so besides what's being sent up there, what's being done about what's up there? What's being done about the trash?
Well, right now, there's absolutely nothing. We're just watching what's going on. And this is why there's now a call for investments to be made to kind of alleviate this congestion. that's happening. The issue that they're trying to do is, should we, you know, one of the ways to mitigate is, could we, for instance, send up satellites that are outfitted with small little thrusters that get engaged, little engines that you turn on when the satellite reaches the end of its life, you turn on these little thrusters that push the satellite into the atmosphere of Earth so that they burn up. This is something that they're testing already on some of these smaller satellites, and it looks like it has the ability, you know, it looks like it might be a successful way. Other options for the larger satellites that are, say, the size of a car or larger, a lot of these are mega communication satellites, and they do pose a big problem, by the way. If they collide, they can cause a huge cloud of shrapnel, which can cause a cascading effect. So to prevent that, we need to capture these with other satellites. So there would be these satellites that would be able to attach themselves to these dead satellites and then push them into the atmosphere to burn up. And those are the things that we're testing right now on a smaller scale. But to be able to do that to large, you know, something that's the size of an SUV, that's going to be, you know, really interesting, a problem to solve.
Okay, and speaking, you mentioned earlier SpaceX, and I also mentioned wine in space. Those two are kind of connected. They're taking up and bringing back lots of stuff as sort of like the cargo fleet for the International Space Station, and part of that fleet included wine.
Yes, this was Bordeaux wine from France that was lifted up over a year ago, put up to the International Space Station. The idea here is to see how the wine ages in space. And they were now brought back after being over a year in space, and they will be uncorked and tasted by a professional connoisseur wine tasters to see how, in fact, wine does age over time in space. I guess the interesting part of this, Peter, is, you know, if we look into the future of people traveling long distances in space, they would want to bring some of the things that, you know, are the finer things in life to enjoy when you're away, maybe for many years on a journey. And perhaps it'd be interesting to see, can wine in microgravity or zero gravity really age well? So we'll find out in the coming weeks.
I know they sent up, 320 Merlot and Cabernet Sauvignon wines. And I'm just curious, I would assume they're going to taste it in comparison perhaps with other wines from the same batch that didn't leave the planet.
Well, I mean, yeah, you'd have to have some kind of comparison to see what would happen, you know, what is the difference between, you know, if you have the batch, the same batch, half of them going up, half of them being on the ground, seeing what the difference is. So it'll be interesting to see definitely if there's any change in the taste of these fine wines.
And finally, again, speaking of SpaceX, we've got a couple of minutes to go here. SpaceX, in addition to bringing wine back and forth, is pretty busy these days.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, Peter, this is really exciting because they're now in the middle of testing what they're calling their SpaceX calls their mega ship called Starship. They're doing series of high altitude hops, basically going up into the atmosphere up to 10 kilometers with this giant rocket, beautiful silvery rocket. It's a prototype. They're, you know, testing the engines, seeing the maneuverability of these of this newly designed rocket. Elon Musk has said to his team that the development of the Starship line, it takes precedence over anything else right now in terms of developing new rockets. It's designed to carry upwards of 100 people potentially in the future and cargo to the moon, Mars, and even to the outer solar system into the far future. They're hoping, I mean, this is the rocket ship that you probably have heard of that the Japanese billionaire signed on to a trip to go around the moon in the year 2024. This is the rocket that would take tourists into space and eventually humans to Mars. So it's really important to get these tests down. It's a stainless steel craft. It harkens, Peter, a lot. If you see it, it looks like how rocket ships were in the old science fiction movies from the 1950s.
Have you booked your ticket yet?
Not yet. I want to see how this thing actually works. So I'm watching these tests in the next few months.
And how far along are the tests? What is the prognosis as to when they will actually go beyond tests and put this into operation? at least cargo-wise?
If all the tests go well in the, over the next, probably the next year, year and a half, then they'll the, probably the first missions will be to have trips of people around the Earth to do orbital trips, short orbital hops. And then, of course, doing a the ultimate test before tourists go would be to go a trip around the moon, which would be about a one-week trip. So that's scheduled for 2024, but they're going to have to really pick up the pace to be able to keep that schedule. There's already talk of the 2024 launch date for the moon trip to be slipping. So we'll see how it goes. There's a lot of tricky engineering ballet maneuvering that this rocket does when it lands. And that's the really the tricky part, to be able to safely land this rocket back on onto the pad on the ground. In December, the last time they did this, the whole maneuvering, everything went well, except it hit the ground so hard, the spacecraft blew up. So hopefully, I mean, they'll be able to figure that landing to really stick it properly before moving on.
Yeah, when I hear this story, my mind wanders to an augmented version of the theme song to Gilligan's Island. But anyway, Andrew,
you know, you could do everything perfectly and ace everything, except if you don't stick the landing, that kind of doesn't work out too well.
Yeah, plus you also get bad scores from the European judges.
Exactly.
Andrew, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you once again.
Great to be here. I wish everyone clear skies.
Andrew Fizakis, the night sky guy, and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the number for this show, which is show number 0598, and you'll find links to his site, plus also links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
You know, try as I may, it seems to be increasingly difficult to stop mining the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January the 6th for candidates for this weekly award. But these clowns just keep falling into my lap. It actually drives home the scary fact at the possibility of how successful this coup might have been if it actually involved competent people. Thankfully, it did not. So, here is the latest winner. 53-year-old Thomas Fee was in Washington, D.C. during the insurrection. After his girlfriend posted on Facebook that Fee was at the rally, her brother sent Fee a text asking if he was in Washington. Fee replied with a selfie from inside the Capitol's rotunda and bragged he was at the tip of the spear. The unnamed brother wasn't just interested for personal reasons. As a special agent for the State Department, he was actively involved in the response to the insurrection. He turned over the image, text messages, and a video Fee also sent to the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force. Fee, a retired New York City firefighter, was charged with felonies. You know, this is proof once again that if he was smart enough not to incriminate himself, he probably would have been smart enough not to have been there at all. Because why? Oh, why? Would you send a selfie of you in the Capitol Rotunda to the brother of your girlfriend who just happens to be a special agent for the State Department? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0598. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links to all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0598. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on Patreon.com, or you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes.
Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.